This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives, with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay as your co-hosts. And today we have several guests for our conversation, and we're going to take up a topic that is timely now that the some of the benefits from the pandemic era have been dialed back, and more families are falling between the cracks of making too much money to get assistance that they need, but not enough to be truly independent. And today we're going to hear about a program that local congregations are doing to provide household items to families in need. Also a little bit about what the specifics of that need look like now in this changing environment. And then I hope to spend much of our time talking about what are the challenges of sharing critical resources across differences of poverty, economic class, race, culture, religion. What do we need to be sensitive to, and what should we be doing, and how does this program attempt to address it? Also, just more deeply so that people can understand what these needs look like. So with that being said, I want to just name the people here. Jamie Breedlove from Loving Care Ministries at St. Paul's, Mary Clabby, a member of First Unitarian Society of Ithaca, Chuck Tompkins with Community Faith Partners, but just as a citizen also who's been caring about these issues for years, Jess Brock from the Village at Ithaca, and Merrill Phipps, in addition to Peaches Gillette and myself. So I'm going to suggest, Jamie, you're the program that you are spearheading, trying to get congregations involved in, is what initiated this conversation. So why don't you start by describing it, and then we can turn to the needs that to going more deeply into the needs that it tries to address, and then some of the challenges.
So my interest in this began after you had sent out an email about this program that we're looking for other congregations to spearhead this program. And then I didn't really know what it involved. And so I then met with Judith Jones from the Unitarian Church. And then I realized that Merrill Phipps was the director of Village at Ithaca, and Merrill and I have known each other through different places. And so then I went and had a conversation with Merrill. And I think Eric, it would actually be better if we began with Merrill, because she then outlined how the program got begun initially. So I think that would give us the best history possible.
And yes, and I'm going to do a little thing here. The way Jamie heard about this was through a newsletter that I send out to about 400 people who are leaders or participants in spiritual religious communities in Tompkins County. And if you want to receive that newsletter, you can actually contact me at info@madeofclay.org. But this is actually a funny roundabout story. So Merrill, take it away.
Sure, thank you. This is such an exciting call to be on, especially because I know so many of you in multiple ways, all connected to either my personal village or our larger professional village. So this is a program that started as a partnership between the First Unitarian Society of Ithaca and the Village at Ithaca in spring of 2020. So after the very public murder of George Floyd, many groups and organizations locally were looking for ways to truly exemplify what they knew was an important commitment to anti-racism. And many organizations who were new to the concept of DEI work didn't know what that meant, right? We here at the Village were a fairly small organization at that time. We're still fairly small compared to some larger places, but we were small enough that when the COVID-19 pandemic ordered that we shut down, we thought to ourselves, well, okay, but we can be flexible. We will figure something out. So we closed our offices because New York State said you had to. And then my staff and I called every family and young person that we had interacted in the past 12 months and said, what do you need? And if you recall that time, what they said they needed was toilet paper, food and cleaning supplies because we were having a global pandemic. Their kids were no longer getting breakfast and lunch at school, and toilet paper was like gold. So that was how that started. And so when I met with Judy Jones from FUSIT, and she said, my congregation needs to do something. We need action. We need to do something. I said, you know, racial justice, all justice is intersectional, right? So it's related to food justice. It's related to gender justice. Barriers are barriers across all systems. And I said, my families are hungry and my families need cleaning supplies. And I am one human with three staff. In spring 2020, my teenage son and I would get up every Friday and we'd go to the GIAC food distribution. And I'm not strong because I do not exercise. So he'd come with me and he would load the boxes and we would drive my minivan all over town, all over the county to the families that we knew. And so when Judy came, I was like, guess what? I could use some more drivers and some more minivans. And Judy said, that we can do. And that's where this started. And then she connected with new congregations. And now here we are 3 years later at a really good opportunity to continue to say, guess what? These needs continue to exist. They existed before the pandemic. They're going to continue to exist after the pandemic. And we should, if we can, we should continue to fill them.
Right, right. And even though we may have lived in this community for many years, I didn't know the specific narrative you just told us, or the story, or how this all, because I came about it in a circuitous way.
Mm-hmm. So then back to when I got the notification, I saw it and didn't think much of it, but then my pastor forwarded it to me again and said, since I am the liaison of our church for the local and world missions, she said, do you think this would be something that local and world missions would like to take part in? So, and immediately, you know, because local world missions and our church were already helping with Ithaca Kitchen Cupboard, I said, as a representative for Area Congregations Together, that's where I met Eric. And then we're doing the blue cupboards. People are donating to the blue cupboards. And I'm thinking, well, why would I need one more project to work on? Well, it just so happened that I met Judy Jones, and she came by and had a conversation with me. Then I found out that Merrill is the director, and I was just like, okay, we can do this, because it seemed in my head, I think the most important thing that I remember, that I realized right now that Merrill just said, is everybody, all churches during this period of time, they need, feel like we need to do something. And I think I was really glad to hear you say that, Merrill, because of the fact that, you know, in each one of us, when we have something that comes up, that there is a racial injustice, or someone gets killed, or someone gets hurt, or someone is missing something, we think, we need to do something, but we don't know what to do. And so most of the time, I just end up feeling like a privileged white person that can't do enough, but doesn't know what to do. So I end up doing, if I become totally overwhelmed, I just don't do anything other than, you know, shell out some more money. So I had this thought that I can't go to my church and ask them to commit, you know, $500 a month for these. But if I went to each church within particularly our downtown area, I would be, if they would each contribute one item plus several packs of four rolls of toilet paper, then for around $50 or so, their congregation would be able to provide, collectively, we'd be able to provide up to 10 or 12 items each month that would be a place for us to do something, but collectively, so that maybe these kids don't go to our church, maybe they don't go to any church, but they could see a community of faith organizations that care about them. And so this has been my goal, is to try and get 10 churches to sign on. We're about just less than halfway there. But the fact is, it did give me a recognition and a realization of how many different churches are trying to do something. And so that is what I've in the last, we've done it now, this is our second month. Well, the first month, St. Paul's gathered a bunch of items together. We had a parishioner who gave us some money. I went and bought them. The next month, we put it out to the different congregations, and those we've gone through one round of that. We're now in our third month of trying to put this all together collectively, and we're building on it, albeit slowly, but, you know, at least we're making some strides, and we're trying to do something together. You know, the statement, we're better together, and I believe that that's true, and I am particularly impressed by the fact that, first of all, Meryl, you and your son did this. Second of all, Pusick came on and said, I want to help. Then Temple Bethel said, we'll help too. And so they carried it for 3 years. And these are elderly folks that don't have, you know, they may have, their hearts are really pure in wanting to help. And so how can we not help them? So that's my whole goal of how it is and how it's supposed to go. Now, what I'm finding is, in talking to each church, they're all doing something. They may be doing it differently. They may be doing it too, because as we all know, Tompkins County is very rich in services and very rich in needs. And so we're all trying to do something. But if possible, it would be great, in my opinion, if we could get this particular endeavor all going the same way together on one wagon, rather than having 10 different wagons going different directions. So that's where I am. So thank you for the time to talk about.
Let's take a moment and cut to music.
Love is but a song we sing, fears that we will die. You can make the mountains ring or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing and you may not know why, smile on your brother, everybody get together. Try to love one another right now. Some may come and some may go. He will surely pay his. When the one that left us here turns for us at last, we are but a moment's sunlight fading in the grass. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another. Try to love one another right now. Thank you. together, trying to love one another right now. If you hear the song I sing, you will understand. Listen. You hold the key to love and fear, all in your trembling hand. Just one key unlocks them both, it's there at your command. People now, smile on your brother, everybody get together, try to love one another right now. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together, try to love one another right now. I said, come on, people now, smile on your brother, together.
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives, with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. And our conversation today is about getting household items to families who need them. And working with my understanding is that this is a Village at Ithaca related service, but it's not, you're looking for other people to take on the legwork as much as possible. Is that, am I correct, Meryl?
It's something that definitely we cannot do or maintain without significant volunteers. So even while we've been talking outside my window, a young high school senior who needed a community service credit for the afternoon came and picked up the last 10 bags to donate this afternoon. So initially we were covering it with just staff, but we have grown from 12 families to 30 families. So we cannot do it without other human people. And I should say that we also can't do it without Friendship Donation Network, which is our community partner who provides the food. So we pick up the food that accompanies the household items every Friday. Usually staff do that. And then we have some volunteers who come in and help sort. And then it goes from there. But yes, this is definitely something that we could not sustain without volunteers. And honestly, naively, at the beginning of the pandemic, when we all kept thinking, oh, this can't last that long, we're going to get vaccines, it's going to be over, we thought this will be a 6-month program. This will just be a little gap filling, you know, the kids will go back to school and everything will be fine. And as I said before, it's not, and it's a need, and it continues to be a need. And one thing that I do want to emphasize is that the families that we serve in this way are then significantly more comfortable reaching out when they need something else, or connecting to their neighbors and saying, hey, this is someone in the community who can help you with this. So often we have families who just sign up, or we just, you know, call because they heard that we give detergent. And then it turns out they really needed some help navigating some complex educational stuff or racial discrimination in a local system. So it's really given us a way to some buy-in with our local community.
So it's creating relationships where there maybe weren't any or just tenuous ones.
Yes. Yeah.
And you said that your need has grown from what, 12 to 30 families? And my understanding is it may even be more than that. In the not too distant future.
Oh, the need is significant. I mean, if we could meet Jamie's dream of streamlining the entire faith-based community in the county to this type of service, we could be serving hundreds of families, probably thousands of families. This is it's a real gap. We are simultaneously service rich and gap rich, right? So it's almost like the more things pop up, the more space there is between them. So,
and I would just say that this this idea that you have to be poor to realize this gap, you know, I think is I think that everyone, including but particularly middle class people that are doing okay, but they're right on that middle class crack, is what I always call it, is the fact that you can, and you can really identify with this, because I know that, you know, as far back as when I had my children, I agreed to breastfeed if my husband would agree to buy the disposable diapers, you know, because I didn't want to have to be washing them all the time. And, you know, that sort of thing, right? Because formula cost a lot of money because it wasn't the best for my children, you know, that sort of thing. And then my children got older and I needed sanitary products. Then I had two daughters who needed sanitary products. And that is so expensive. And people that, and people who are in on food stamps and on services and that sort of thing, they still doesn't mean they have cash for all of those things that are not covered by SNAP. And so whether you are, you know, penniless, or whether you are middle class, or even if you are a person of substance and financial stability that just wants to be, you know, manage their money properly, you realize how unfair it is for the cost of toilet paper to cost so much, the cost of sanitary products to cost so much, the cost of diapers to cost so much, because of the fact these are needed items that you cannot just go and get anywhere, and you have to have them. It's not a matter of saying, well, I don't want that brand. You must need a need. You just have a need, and it has a problem to be met. And so that's, you know, if you have limited resources at all, then the shrinking of the SNAP benefits is going, oh, I'm going to get less food, but I'm also not going to have money for XYZ. And the stereotype of your child not being able to have clean clothes to go to school, your child not having the ability to have clean hair or clean bodies or XYZ, or go through that time of the month and you don't have the ability to have what you need for supplies, that can be denigrating for anyone and mm-hmm. everyone. But at the same time, we have to meet them where they are with these extra things that we can't even imagine, fathom not being able to buy. So.
Right. I, you know, as I'm listening to this conversation, there are a couple of things that I want to plug in. And one of them is, you know, I'm relatively new to Ithaca, shocked by the overwhelming whiteness and white privilege. And what I don't want to do is to sit here and pat ourselves on the back without honoring the history of people and churches who have been doing this forever. This did not start here. We did not invent this wheel. And we have to understand that people have been pitching in, not just in institutional levels, but on family levels, to help one another survive through what they need to survive through. Right. Whether those people were Black or white or otherwise. And when I sit here, and if I were an objective listener, I would think that only white people do this for one another, when people have been doing this for one another for centuries. Right. I grew up that way. I grew up in churches that worked that way. My mother grew up in churches that worked that way. And I just want to plug that into our conversation.
Right. And I grew up in a rural community in Northwest Missouri, where prior to food stamps, people would go in and they would take what they needed from the stores and they would check out. And if they didn't have money to pay for it, they would sign the chit, and the chit would go into a box. And every once in a while, they would ask, would you like to make a payment? And people would sign chits who had a lot of money too, because everybody did this and nobody looked particularly like, it was just the way it was done. And granted, there were stigmas and there were issues, but at the same time, at the end of the year, whatever chits had remained unpaid, they would be written off by the local banks, like by the local businesses paying the grocery store owner, or the grocery store owner absorbing those losses. And that's how, and people made contributions to that. So, and yes, we've done it. We've handled this in a lot of different ways in a lot of different communities over time. Ithaca, from about 1980 to about 2000 or 2010, lost much of its lower middle class, its middle class. You couldn't afford to live here anymore. And our workforce is largely commuting, 30%, 40% commutes in from out of the county because they can't afford to live here. So we have a hollowed out middle class. We have more extremes of privilege and poverty here in some ways. So that's another piece, which is, I think, that you're picking up on in the white privilege here.
Okay, so couldn't we just, is this an appropriate time to ask a question of Peaches?
Sure.
So I think that's a really good point that you just brought up, Peaches, is the fact that we're a group of white people that are talking about the minus right. Jess, but we're talking about this. So obviously we're white, and it's except for you, of course, but the question is, what should we be doing that's different from trying as white people to help? What should be, how do we do something different to be, yes, I'm not saying that you're not saying that we're being helpful. I'm just saying, what would be the best action in this position?
No, I wasn't criticizing the actions.
Oh, and I don't feel that. I was just
okay, good, because
what
I was
your
just,
thought
I
is about that.
Something was missing in our conversation.
Okay.
And so what I'd like to do is continue talking, and then I will plug in more that might answer what you're asking.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Because that's been my biggest whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
What business do I have as a white person trying to help other? But and I'm at Village at Ithaca. They do have a lot of people that are of different races and ethnicities, but they also help people that are white as well, right? I mean, you're not limiting to different races. Is that correct, Meryl?
Mm-hmm. No.
That's true.
Go right ahead. Yes.
I think one thing that resonated for me when Peaches was speaking is that when I talk about gaps, I think that's exactly what I'm talking about, is that Tompkins County, for its size, should be doing a much better job taking care of ourselves as a community and you know, replicating the communities that many of us did grow up with, in which we took care of ourselves, in which we were a village that was raising our children, right? I think because of our university town, because of the overwhelming whiteness, because of the overwhelming privilege here, there's a really heightened sense of individualism in this community that has really detracted from our ability to sort of work together and serve our own in a larger capacity. Jess likes to say, okay, Ithaca, we need a team meeting. Like we are not so big that we should be fragmented in this way. This should not be novel. It's actually, this is something that people have been doing and should be doing as people who care about ourselves as a giant family. And that's sort of, I think, why we, you know, the village historically has been very focused on academic success, right? And then when we first sort of started this move, some of the people who had been supporting us a long time were confused. They didn't understand how it was related to our mission. But anyone who's ever been a parent or a caregiver knows that it is incredibly isolating to do it by yourself. And that, like, you cannot, it is very hard to raise your children, support your children when you don't have what you need. And so for us, it was absolutely mission aligned and part of that larger conversation about how we as a county and we as a community need to be more of a village together. So thank you for that point.
Also, I think that we, you know, when we talk about being more of a village and more of a community, there's kind of like this split in our consciousness about whether we can truly and fully do that when we don't build relationships with people. Mm-hmm. Because our charity is not relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Our charity is business. We're forming business relationships through charity. We are not forming relationships through our humanity and through connecting, like sitting on somebody's front porch or things like that. We're not doing that. And as long as we don't do that, as far as I'm concerned, we are always going to have a gap. Mm-hmm. Not only a gap in getting volunteers, we may have people out there who won't even come to us and ask us for anything because they don't want to feel like they're being beggars to a business.
Right.
And so we are limiting ourselves when we have not figured out how to form relationships across all sorts of lines, color lines, class lines, and things like that. And we have not, in my estimation. And I've been here for 5 years and I'm still waiting.
Let's take a moment and cut to music.
It isn't right for too many falling. They see us in the name of the great good. Oh, we lost sight. World is getting colder. What happened to the words for which we once stood? I will stand for you. Could you stand for me? Everybody deserves to be free. I would lend a hand to you. Would you lend a hand to me? Everybody deserves to be free. It's close to night, but I leave a candle burning. Slow light, your way home. Won't give up the fight. Story's over.
So, Mary, what would you say?
Yes. Well, I'm also new to Ithaca. I did some work in Charleston, South Carolina. And this relational aspect is so important. I think at the Unitarian Church, and we're right now missing Judy Jones, I think her help and her part in this issue is really foundational. But I realized right away that the best way maybe to move this forward through a huge congregation is to work within the one or two people that knew what was going on, so Judy, Jamie, and so on. But also I presented it. I thought, let me present this to the whole congregation. I didn't hear anything back. Then I presented it to my small group of eight people with whom I have friendships. This is a small group that meets every 2 weeks. Love these folks. And they were right on board to help. It's $6 a month for them. It's $12 for 2 months. Let's get this going with this one small group, take leadership of it, and maybe bring it then to the rest of the congregation. I don't know. I'm right. Hoping that works. Yeah.
That funds and the supply chain for the goods to make it to the people who need them. But that is not the team meeting. And I want to hear from Jess what she meant by team meeting.
Okay, great. So I have a lot of thoughts, but I will say I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who just graduated. I graduated from Ithaca College. So it's truly like my first time actually being a part of the community. As Meryl has mentioned before, Ithaca is kind of known as like a college town, a place where people come to learn, to cultivate, to grow, and then they leave. And sometimes we miss like that relational part of like, oh, what does this community need in the moment, like while I'm here? I will speak on what like Peach said too. Like I go to Christian Community Church, CCC, at Southside every Sunday. And something we do to help food insecurity in Ithaca is after every service, we'll like buy a can of goods from Wegmans and leave it in the blue bins. We'll notice even after church, like people will peek through their like windows around the corners with like bags, like they're waiting for us to get out of church so they can fill their bags up with food. Like even sometimes in the night, like if I'm like coming back from work or whatever, and I'm passing by the community center, people like wait by those blue bins. I think a lot of times with Ithaca in general, I feel like they don't want to put action to something unless they see something. Like speaking back on to what you said about George Floyd, like people didn't care about race or race relations or DEI work or being a part of the community until they saw someone dead. And it's not that, you know, the village isn't saying anything. It's not that Southside isn't speaking up. No, we're speaking. We're saying we need help. Like there are people in the community that are saying they need help, but everyone wants to try to like say like, I don't know. They try to like make it more of like a system to get help rather than helping. Like if you know you can provide the help. You're at Wegmans, you go shopping every day, you have an extra 10 cents to grab a can of whatever or a pack of ramen noodles, leave them in the blue bins. I feel like a lot of the times Ithaca continues to have conversation without action. Not to like speak right now, but like look at us right now, we're all talking, we're like, okay, well what's the best way to like provide the help. Like go to the store and grab your extra $5 that you had in your purse. Maybe you find like a little dollar on the floor, pick that up and put some food in the blue bin. We get so caught up in conversations and talking about how is this going to work. If we say we're a faith-based group or like we're faith-based groups that want to help, we're faith-based people who want to help. Okay, let's stop talking about it and do it. Who has the money? Who has the time? Who has the resources? Let's pick it up and let's do it. And stop talking about it, because we're talking about it right now. Somebody could be at the blue bin right now waiting for food. And like Meryl said, like someone was just outside our window getting ready to drop off bags of food. I think there just has to be less talking and more action towards it. Even if someone can't be a part of like the faith-based organizations, like someone maybe doesn't go to church every day, but knows that they have 10 minutes after work to be able to drop something off. You know what I mean? Those are all my thoughts.
I think if I were to just pick up on that, what you're saying, Jess, is that in my mind, there's a careful distinction between delivery systems and delivering people. And I think we're talking about relationships, so that I'm sure the blue bin is a great idea, but that takes out the relational component. That meets the need of what the person has, but it doesn't build the relationship. And so how in the world can we both take care of and regard each other as persons? And I think what Jamie had talked about earlier, and even in a previous meeting at St. Paul's, is that hopefully in the delivery of goods, there's the building of a relationship. The consistency of delivering food to a person. I remember Cal Walker telling me decades ago, He said, you know, Chuck, the reality of the racial gap that exists is only going to be bridged when we find each other in each other's living rooms. And I think there's a ton of truth to that. And it all of this comes down to, not all of it, but most of it comes down to how are we doing at building relationships. And so if this need and filling the gap can be built relationally as a bridge, then I think it's a win-win situation. It's not simply just meeting a need for toilet paper and for sanitary goods and all the other that's on that list, but how are we developing a relationship with that person and restoring a sense of dignity to those who may not have a sense of dignity just by nature of where they are at this stage of life. So I just want to underline the need for a relationship.
Yeah, I think if we're taking on this idea of like the Blue Bin, to a way to cultivate relationships could be to leave a sign, a simple sign on the door that says, hey, we are, this is very random, but hey, we are Village at Ithaca and we would like to serve our community in the best way possible. Feel free to collect anything you need from this Blue Bin. And if you need other services, please visit our office address or please call number. Because I notice a lot of the times, like when we do food distribution at Art House, mm-hmm. like there will be people who come in and like grab food, but there will also be people who wait and like kind of wait for people to leave. Because some people may not feel confident enough to want to go and get the resources out of someone's hands. Like as we were mentioning before, like as Peaches mentioned before, people don't want to be beggars. They don't want to like beg from a business to ask for resources. Creating that relationship is absolutely important. I hear that wholeheartedly. And I think we could do more on our part to like market ourselves more as a help system. But you also have to realize like if we're going to be a help system, we have to reach them where they are. Maybe some people don't have like, you know, phones or like computers or ways that they can connect online to say, oh, like, you know what? Like I found Village's Instagram. I found Village's Facebook. Let me call them. Some people only know I can go to the Blue Bin. There might be something in there if I'm lucky. So we have to meet them where they are. If they're at the Blue Bin, we have to have a sign at the Blue Bin or we have to be at the Blue Bin. I didn't even know about, there's a community who serves food, I think, like every Tuesdays and Wednesday, like downtown.
Loaves and Fishes.
I didn't know about them until after I graduated. But I like had to pass by chance to see the sign that's like, oh, like they give out food every so-and-so. But right. Like, how do we reach to those communities? We have to meet them where they are. And sometimes that's just as easy as leaving a sign on the door saying who we are.
Well, let me play with Loaves and Fishes just a second here. One of the unique things about Loaves and Fishes is when you go there, you sit down and you have a meal with other people. It doesn't matter what their race, religion, age is, and you don't have to be food insecure to eat there. Nobody asks you. And I used to go in and eat on occasion just to have relationships. And the question that we are avoiding is how do we actually have relationships? Because friends don't let friends go hungry or go without what they need at home. But if, you know, how do we have the relationships that and as Chuck was saying, Cal Walker said, until we're in each other's living room. So that's really awkward because we don't all have spaces that we want to have other people in, or we don't necessarily know we want others. I don't know. We still have the question still on the table. And Peaches, yeah. Can you step in here?
Yeah, you know, but you opened the door for it. I mean, look, there are people that like, you know, no matter whether you're feeding them or not, they're just like, they're not those people. You know what I mean? But the point is that you open the door for it. You open the compassion door for it. And if somebody steps through it, that's great. When I'm talking about, I'm always listening to literally endless talk about building relationships. And it becomes frustrating because that's all I'm listening to. We are, you know, I say to my friend, this is all we can figure out with our big brains, for God's sakes, that we don't know how to go to somebody's house, even if you're bringing them food. Bring a cup of coffee and sit down. Bring a cup of coffee and sit down and say, look, well, how was your day? What did you do? What are your children doing? What are your ages? That's what we don't do. We are so busy saving the world that we forget about the individuals that we're supposed to be saving or helping. And I see that in every organization that I've been a part of since I've been up here. is that our conversations about how can we change the world and how can we save the community and how can we save this, and we don't talk about the individuals that are part of that community at all. We look at what we do as a project. That's the way I feel. And when you look at people as a project, you are not going to move past that. And when I said, I don't care if you're sitting on somebody's porch. I don't care if you're sitting somewhere. I don't care if you're sitting in the grass in Stewart Park. Sit together. When I grew up, we didn't need a handbook for how to be friends with people, for God's sakes. Now we need books on how to do this, and we're still failing at it. It's absurd to me. You say to somebody, hey, what do you like? Do you like a movie? Do you like this? Whatever. That's how you build friendships, by being casual, not by being business.
Yeah.
You need both aspects, but we're missing the vital other aspect. And so we will never be whole in what we're doing.
So can we bring this back to Merrill? This has worked in the last 3 years because it started out with the pandemic. You couldn't go into people's houses. You couldn't build relationships. You couldn't, you know, have coffee with them, that sort of thing. But how would that work at this space and time?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a couple things that I'm hearing, and we talk about this a lot. We're often contacted by other groups and asked to bring groups of young people to do different projects, you know? And what I usually say is, like, who is this for? Like, why are you inviting us? Are you inviting us for us? For these kids? Is this an opportunity for these kids? Are they going to feel safe in your space? Or are you inviting you because you think you as an organization have to have more Black and brown kids in your audience, you know? And so I think the individual relationship conversation is one too, right? Like, exactly, both Jess and Peach, they're like, not everybody wants to be offered the cup of coffee. And I also, I think that one thing that I see in, so there is that it has to start with our individual attitudes, right? Is that, like, there is an inherent power imbalance of being a person with resources who can share resources with someone else. However, there is we have to get rid of any sort of internalized judgment or bias around that, as we are all people with needs who are either have previously struggled, have needs in other ways, are, you know, one step away. It's just luck, right? And so I think that being approached by someone who's delivering food to you, but who's also doing it in a way that feels judgy or projecty or businessy, is not the same as truly building honest relationships. And also, people are not a monolith, right? So the 30 families that we serve all probably need to be approached 30 different ways, right? And it's after 3 years of committing to these families, I think we have some good information, but it's a long-term commitment, right? So it's like relationship building, and you know this from being a person who has friends, is it's a long-term commitment. You have to be thoughtful. You have to figure out what people need. You have to put yourself aside, right? So I think that now that we know that we can sustain this particular thing in this one particular group of families, right, we can be thoughtful about what that looks like. And, you know, just talked about our address pantry, and that it's true. There's a very disparate group of people who need certain things. But the thing that I like most about that particular project is it's just that we're there on Thursdays sometimes, you know, like people come and hang out, people come and mill about. It's exactly the kind of community building that we want to be talking about, right? So figuring out how to establish that sort of, this is just what we do, instead of like project and business mentality, is a good next step.
So when you say we just show up on a weekly basis, is it the same group of people who are showing up?
Nope, it's different because it's, you know, it's based on who's available. And like I said, most people, I think, are grateful that we drop things and go, right? Sure. Like, they're busy families. They really just need the toothpaste. Like, they, if there are people who are deliverers who are, something that has been helpful to us, and actually Mary is a good example of this, is that, you know, Mary works with one particular young person who needed some support in one particular way. Like, it is not super helpful to be like, I'm going to build a relationship every Friday for 5 minutes. But if you are a person with capacity, one thing that we have done is that we, and also, you're not going to get along with everyone. Like, we try to thoughtfully coordinate people who we think their kids are their same age, or they're both interested in this, or they have similar vibes. They both like gardening, and we've connected families in that way to build relationships. And some of that has gone really well. But you have to know people first in order to do that. And so that's, I think we're doing the work of knowing while we're doing the work of delivering.
Right. But what I hear Peach is asking for is to not so carefully engineer the connection, but to find a way to discover, have an openness that explores whether that connection is possible. And then how do you informally take it to the next, how's your day been? You know, not just delivering the good kindly and slipping away, but that's a nice flower outside your house, or that's a nice whatever, your children, are having fun in the front yard or whatever in front of the apartment building or whatever. It's having that ease to say something and then to see, is there any life here without expectations?
Mm-hmm. But I think we also want to honor what Meryl is talking about, because yes, that would be great for me to have 30 new friends, because I bought, a thing of laundry detergent and put it in a bag with everybody else's. It would be great to have 30 new friends. But the fact is that I shouldn't have that expectation that I'm going to make 30 new friends when I'm doing this on behalf of Village at Ithaca. I don't want to say, hey, Jamie's doing this and had this great idea, now y'all come and help and we're going to make friends. But I want to keep it narrow enough to say, this is something that we're helping Village at Ithaca, and we follow their direction in the way that we spread it out. If we could, because we're not accomplishing that goal yet. I mean, the one purpose is, Mayor, and he's raising his hand.
Right.
Is that we are giving, our goal is to get people to help the Village at Ithaca. And then where do we go from there? I guess is my point about this particular thing.
And so I guess there's a challenge.
Completely different things, right?
Right.
Right. Right. Right.
Can I just point out, most people need 30 to 70 relationships to maintain resilience in their lives, 30 to 70 reciprocal relationships. That's kind of where people stand. You have more than you know. You have most, almost everybody has 10 times more than they realize. It's really wild. But anyway, so what we were talking about before was, how can you be friendly so that commitment to community, which happened, it's not ordained by an organization. We're not there as the servants of an organization. We're there as human beings to connect in a very limited way with other human beings. It happens to be orchestrated by the Village at Ithaca or by other group of congregations. Many, many congregations suffer from an inability to foster relationships. You described First Unitarian as having small groups. That's a way that many congregations try to overcome the tendency to not be able to foster more open friendliness, is to have small groups because they don't know how to do it. I've talked too much here, but Peaches, you were going to jump in before.
Yeah, because I think there's a misunderstanding of what we feel is relational.
Yes.
Relationships. Absolutely. I'm not talking about taking on 30 best friends or 40 best friends or things like that. I'm not talking about that at all. We have, even in our own intimate friendships, we relate to those people very differently. Like, I have friends that I talk on the phone for with a long time, or friends I watch movies with and things like that. Very different relationships. What I'm talking about is an intimacy. And that intimacy could be for 8 minutes or a lifetime. And we have no intimacy with people. And intimacy is fostered through a friendliness and fostered through commiserating. If there's one thing that people love to do, they love to commiserate with one another. Not just to say, okay, here's the food, or not just to say, I'm only here because you need something, but to say, I'm here because I know that we are struggling in the same boat. I see what's happening. I see the inequality in distribution. I know the pain in the neck the systems can be. If you had a brief conversation like that, that is the relationship. That's what I'm talking about. Not that I'm only here because you have a need. I can be with you because I do it with my friends who, you know, who like need a six pack of beer one night. You know what I mean? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about saying like, man, this day was a drag, or this day was glorious, or this day was this. Not and expand ourselves beyond what's material, because that's really what we're doing. Expand ourselves beyond that we are the institution as opposed to we are the human beings. And that's what we do as human beings. We talk, we complain, we talk about the weather, we commiserate over, we talk about how nutty our kids are, what a pain in the neck, whatever it is. That's what we do. And that is the relationship. That could happen in 2 minutes, that could happen in 30 seconds. It's still a relationship.
But to offer that relationship, how do you get past the tendency for people to feel that they're being targeted? This is a thing here locally. People feel targeted to be served, and they don't want to be targeted. But how do you cut through that assumption? How do you offer something that allows? Go ahead.
I think you have to, you know how they say sit with it? Sometimes you have to sit with other people's and your own shame, whatever is required in the moment, in the interaction, because you could go to a grocery store and that is a relationship. You're having an interaction with someone. You can choose to give something of yourself and they can give back. But in this type of thing, there's almost like a little wall. And like Jess was saying, we're talking too much. We are talking too much. You got to jump over that wall or through that wall and make the first connection, whatever it is. I have an odd story to tell you that in the South, there was never any of this talking. We just jumped in after Dylann Roof shot and killed 9 people at the school across the street where I taught. There was no time to do this, but there is still shame everywhere about our relationships with each other when we're choosing to be the power. The people with the power, hate saying it, have to use the power and money with people who don't have the power and money. I hate it about being white, but we got to put that stuff aside and move through that wall. They might be thinking the same thing. What are they thinking? I don't know. Let me just try this one thing. Like you said, Eric, let me just, or Peaches, let me try this one. Hey, I like that flower. And you might get totally spurned or scorned. You have to be willing to do that. And I think people are afraid to do that.
Let's take a moment and cut to music.
To be light for the kingdom, to live in the
there's a.
I think. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I was.
I think sometimes we're. This is a good example. Often in my life, I have said, you know, I go into church. Good morning. How are you doing? And people say, fine, good. Hi, how are you? One time here at St. Paul's, someone said, I'm having a hell of a day. And I was halfway down the hall before it connected with what they said. And I had to turn around and go back and say, I heard you say you're having a hell of a day. Tell me about it. Yeah. And I think that's a huge fear that we have, giving and receiving. What if I worked for WIC for 20 years, and one of my jobs at working for WIC was I had to make sure that everyone had all the referrals possible. But then what do I do when they have all those referrals and they're not having their problems solved with all those referrals, or they don't qualify for those services and they still have these needs? Then it was really hard for me to give passive referrals and realistic referrals, which didn't help people. So what do I do when I say, what do you need and how can I help? And they tell me, they are willing to tell me, but I don't have the means or the ability to solve those problems. Then it's really scary. So I failed again. And so then in that way, we have to be willing to hear what's going on. But what do I say when I don't know how to fix what's going on?
But that's an interesting question and a very real question, because we can't always fix what's going on. And to lay that expectation on yourself doesn't help anybody. So right. There are times when you can say to people, and we just have to be more skilled and more graceful about the way we speak and our honesty, is to say, let's see what we can do. I may not be able to do everything. Let's see what we can do together. And I'm telling you that often that's a comfort to people to hear that. They don't need to know that you're trying to do everything for them. All they need to know is you're trying to do your best.
And that they have been seen. They have been seen and heard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just like when somebody, like when the person said to you, I'm having a miserable day, whatever it was they said, you can't fix that. But what you can say is, tell me about it, and I'm sorry to hear that, or whatever it is you say, but the point is not necessarily that I can fix everything just because I walk in the door. Who the hell do you think you are? The point is that I can tell you that I'm going to try to do the best I can with you, you know? And part of that, as I'm sitting and listening, of course, and you know, I do a lot of race relations workshops around Ithaca. Part of what I'm hearing, so I don't want you to get the misunderstanding that I have an attitude towards white people. I'm just saying that we have to be aware of how our whiteness and the way we perceive our own whiteness sets up limitations when it's not necessary. It's not always necessary. It is there, but it's not necessary for us to set up the limitations. And we could even talk about systems that do that. We could talk to people about things like that. Yeah, I can't stand that organization. Yeah, be real and be casual. You know, and that's what I'm saying. And we're not. Everything is like, okay, I have to say the right exact thing. And I can't be too casual because I work for this organization, things like that. I don't know if that's real. I'm not like that. Maybe it's my Black privilege not to be like that. I don't know. But I just see us as being so structured,
right,
in what we're doing, that we have forgotten how to just relate to people on simple levels.
Peaches, I hear you saying, I'm delivering goods for the village at Ithaca, but I'm showing up for me and for you.
Yes. Yes.
And so it takes that, it ceases to be transactional. It ceases to be contractual and it becomes relational. Yeah.
I think so. Or certainly.
I think we do have to go back to Merrill, because ever since I've been working with Judy, she's been saying, we don't do this. We knock on the door, we leave Village at Ithaca, delivering goods, and we leave. So how would that change your, Merrill, your delivery, their delivery system? And is how do you view that?
So part of the reason that we do that is that in the early days, because we've had a wide variety of volunteers who we have not necessarily had the opportunity to talk about how best to build relationships or how to approach people thoughtfully. We had some fairly problematic interactions, you know, and some questions around, I would say some choices that were pretty invasive in terms of families' privacy, right? So I think the key really is about consistency, right? If we have consistent volunteers who are showing up weekly, and like, then that is the foundation for relationship, right? But if we, there needs to be a thoughtful way, and we've tried to sort of develop this sort of training of supporting people in connecting in ways that are truly supportive and not charity tourism, you know? And I think that we have a real issue with that, particularly white people in this community who mm-hmm. want to do the thing and be like, I am a helper, right? So I am the helper, you are the helpy, smile at me, show me your gratitude, right? So that's that's sort of where that role has come from, is to try to sort of avoid those interactions for our families.
Right. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Eric, go ahead.
This is crude, but I used to have a rule when I was in a parish work. I wouldn't let anybody do direct service unless they had asked for services in their lives. They had to go and ask for help before I would encourage them to go out and offer anything, because it, for the very reasons you're pointing out, Meryl, that didn't always work, but it helped to kind of ground yeah. people. And when we work with people, how I show up with care and interest in another human being is unique to me, as well as to the person who's actually I'm showing up to with a bag full of goods. So it has to fit. Finding that space, finding that comfort level is tricky. And I haven't been able to train people. I've been able to get people to relax, to be more human, but I haven't been able to train them in that, because they become too self-conscious. And then they trip all over themselves and all over everybody else. But that's my less than humble experience.
Well, I think that's because on one end, I mean, there seems to be a little bit of a judgment there as to who can help. And I don't like mm-hmm. that. I think everyone has their own evolution mm-hmm. in terms of helping and how they can give. And a gift is not always presented. The heart is not always seen with the gift in it. And what you're trying to say is we need to be a little bit more human about how we are giving in our relationships. But I don't want to cut anybody off for wanting to help and being a klutz or being, I just feel like this. I get what you're saying. We're not perfect. We all have our insecurities about this. We're learning. I'm growing. I don't get it all the time. Mm-hmm. I have a child who's not white. The first time I cleaned her ears out, I gasped because she has brown earwax. My reaction to that was so awkward and dumb and stupid, but I didn't know. And it was almost like our first intimate thing was around her earwax. You know, oh, I have brown earwax, you got yellow earwax. It's an odd story, but it was like a step I needed to take. And right. is what I'm saying. We're all in our own evolution about it. So just growing here.
It's, you know, it what you're saying is very true. And, you know, and I am of a particular age and of a particular nature. And when I hear things like, and we all are always in an evolutionary process, no matter what we're doing in life. And that is real. But when we talk about that in relation to like race issues and things like that, it is not comforting, because we are the people, the Black people are the people, and certainly people of my age are the people who are who feel like we are always being told to wait till we get there and we'll figure this out. You know, I grew up in a racist neighborhood. And of course, in the scheme of racist neighborhoods, there are always those beautiful people, no matter what color they are, who rise to the surface. I grew up in a racist neighborhood that was less awkward about doing exactly what we're doing, what you white people are doing up here. The white people then were less awkward about building relationships than you white people here who have everything in the world that you could possibly have to do. It's so weird to me. I'm sorry to say that. The other thing is, like, often, and like I'm saying, like I'm listening to Marilyn, like, you go, when you go to places, and I want to clarify this, and you'll say, we're from the village of Ithaca, and then what else do you say?
Do you mean at the delivery?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the other thing that I'm realizing is that we started this in COVID, right? So nobody was, mm-hmm. nobody wanted to open their doors. Okay, so our delivery, like, most of our delivery procedures are from that. And I, like, sort of forgot that that was true, is that we were, different people were at different levels of comfort. So we just sort of knock. And people know when we deliver every Friday, it's the same route. So people know to expect it, right? So we normally just leave the bag and knock on the door. And then sometimes people come out and say hi. And I think that particularly delivery drivers who do it every week do have certain families who they chat with, right, while they do it. But the reason, the real reason we started was because we had a pandemic and we weren't
supposed to. Okay, but let's go past the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Let's go past that. Let's get past the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Because the pandemic didn't make us who we are, right?
Right.
So when we go to the door, mm-hmm. what is it that you say you're from the village of Ithaca and you're bringing food, which is fantastic. And is that it? Or, you know, I'm sure it varies from person to person, like you're saying. That is
exactly. It. Yeah. I mean, and some people we just knock and they don't open the door. So we
that's
just,
right. That is true. Right. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. In the past, we've also done some surveys in the past. And I've been like, you know, if you have any questions or you have any thoughts about what could be better, let us know, or our phone number's on the bag too, so people can text or call if they don't like something or need something different. And they do, you know, which has mm-hmm. been great. Like we've learned that some of our families have particular like diabetic needs, so we pre-sort different vegetables. But what I've found for us is it helps to just sort of give an open communication avenue and say, like, reach out when you want to share, you know. And so sometimes we'll get a call later in the day being like, hey, thanks, this would be helpful next week. It's usually very brief. If someone opens the door, hi, we're from the village. Here's your food. See you next week.
And if I, may I
of course.
Chime in?
Mm-hmm.
I think this kind of rounds back to like what we were saying earlier, like relationships, as we know, are a two-way street. And, referring to what everyone was saying earlier, like, it's weird when people feel targeted to like, be like, here, take everything we have. Like, that's not a relationship. That's like a take everything we have. Like, bye. I don't even know what to call that. But humans are very complex.
Jumping.
Everyone has a different, like, right. Like, everyone has a different, like, way to connect with people. Some people would love to have conversation. Like, you know, we drop the bag off at the door. It's like, hey, how are you doing today? Like, is there anything else I can help you with today? Like, how was your day? How are the kids? How was the whatever? And some people are like, we'll wait until we leave before taking the bag. Mm-hmm. But then it comes to like, if we want to cultivate that relationship, we have to meet them where they are. We can't push a relationship that mm-hmm. is not welcomed by the other party. We could leave a card and saying like, hey, we are the village of Ithaca. Please call, please text, or please visit the office. But I think that is just something to be reminded. Like both things can be true and both things can live. Yes, we can knock on the door. We can have everything we say. We can say, hey, come to the greenhouse and have coffee with me. It's on me. And also we can have a relationship with people who may not want to speak to us directly, but always know that this door is open from 8 to 5 or 8 to 6 or however long we're here, if they ever need anything outside of the times that we regularly come by. I just think that's something that needs to be plugged into this conversation. And that I hope both opportunities or both conversations are able to be taken with us. That yes, you should try to cultivate that relationship, but not in a way to where it like feels forced, like standing there waiting at the door until someone opens it and goes, we are the Village at Ithaca, and we're here to like, and we're here to help, and we want to talk about your day. Because what if somebody doesn't want to talk about it? Then it's like,
no, this is a complete misunderstanding.
Right, right.
I'm not saying you're saying anything, but just to speak on the.
I hear completely what you're saying, and what you're saying is very real. That is true. People don't open the door. I wouldn't necessarily open my door every time somebody knocks. That's just a reality. I think that we're having two different conversations. I am talking about the conversation of relationships outside of our connections with the Village of Ithaca or the UU Church. I am talking about Ithaca as a place that is so segregated racially that didn't happen because the Village of Ithaca didn't get to talk to somebody who didn't open the door. This is something that is undercutting everything that we do up in Ithaca, because even outside of our organizations or our churches or whatever, we are not building relationships. And whether somebody wants to talk or not, and that's real, and they don't have to, nobody's forcing anybody to talk, we can still say, how was your day? We can still say that, even if they don't respond to us. Right. And so what I'm saying is that outside of our part in the institutions that we share that are reaching out to people, which is wonderful and necessary, no question about it, how are we building relationships when we talk about community? Because community is not your business. Community is not my church. That's not community. Community is how I present myself in the world to everybody of any color. And clearly we are not crossing those racial boundaries, because when I talk to people of color, they feel like they don't have relationships with white people because white people are presenting themselves as an institution in general.
I think that's absolutely true. It's true in Ithaca. It's true in, you know, quote unquote, human services across the board. We have a little poster we put up that says white supremacy loves boundaries. Like my previous job at this here, I worked in the juvenile justice system, and I, you know, was constantly told not to share things about myself, not to answer the phone after 4:30, not, you know, all of these sort of like top down structures that many of our people who go into the quote unquote, like helping professions, that's how they're educated. That's how MSW programs work. Yeah. That's how our entire Department of Social Services runs, this idea that like, there is a boundary and that you are actually not in community with the people that you are serving. And it's actually sort of radical and revolutionary to do that differently, to answer a phone call and share something about yourself while someone else is sharing about themselves, even though that is so much more equalizing than silently taking information and going ahead. So I think that there's it's a huge attitude shift that I think needs to happen both interpersonally and organizationally.
Right. I want to go back to Jess's example real quick and just say, if I'm at the door, I can say, I can ring the doorbell and say, I'm dropping off a package from the Village at Ithaca. I'm Eric. I hope you're having a wonderful day.
Thank you. Thank you. That's exactly what I'm saying.
And then I can walk away.
That's not because I have anything been, on anybody.
Yeah, yeah. And that it does both things, that it recognizes the institutional organizational commitment and my human being.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Let's take a moment and cut to music.
The things my family did. I am not the voice the pieces of the brokenness inside. I am light. 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 I'm not the mistakes that I have made, or any of the things that caused me pain. I am not the pieces of the dream I left behind.
Jamie, what were you going
to
say?
Jamie, you wanted to say something.
So I, two things, but the first thing is, you know, I was born a relational person, and my whole life has been about trying to be in relationship with everyone that I come in contact with. But it's not easy being a white person trying to build relationships with black people either. Because, I mean, I have lots of friends who I consider my friends, and I want to be a part of their lives, and I want to be invited into their homes, and I want to have dinner with them, and I want to go places with them. And I've not felt really welcome in those spaces either. And I think it's I know that it's backgrounds. I know that it's, you know, the fact that I'm white. I know that it's the fact that they're a different color than me. I know that, but at the same time, sometimes it just gets exhausting desiring and wanting to be in relationship with people who don't receive you into relationship with them as well. So until we start talking about these things, I know Eric was talking before and said, you know, Ithaca is just a real clicky place. They just don't have relationships together. We just don't have this. We just don't. And I thought it was all about me. But of course, you know, as my daughter always says, Mom, it's not all about you. But the fact is that you can desire these types of relationships with all types of people, Asian people, black people, brown people, all these types of people. But there's still this wall that you come up to that you're not brought in when you're trying to give your whole self to whoever you're trying to be in a relationship with. And I don't know the answer to that. And that was one of my questions originally, that when Eric and I were talking, is how do black people or people of color feel about white people giving them things? I mean, does that, is there any, Is there any feeling about that? I don't know. It's a question I'm asking.
But does that, the idea of there being barriers, and there certainly are barriers, there are Black people don't want to know you. That's just a human reality, unfortunately.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That is true. But does that govern your next steps? Does that govern every time you run into a Black person, in the back of your mind you're going, oh, they're Black and they don't want to know me? Does that govern your movement? Because technically we're not talking about what doesn't work. I'm trying to talk about what does work. That's what I'm saying.
That's my question.
What you're saying is true, but there are times when it does work. It would work with me, I could tell you right off the bat.
Well, you're going to get me calling you because you're in the school district, and so am I.
You know?
Mary and I went to the packing of the goods, and Marquise Godfrey was there. And I had seen his mother like 2 weeks before, and she told me that he was there, but I didn't know I would see him there. And I've known Marquise Godfrey before he was born, because I had known his whole family come up through me working for WIC. And I know his mother, I know his grandmother, I know his aunts, I know everybody. And that was the best thing ever about working for WIC, is I would see these mothers when they were pregnant. I would see these kids, now they're coming back having kids of their own. My heart just soared when I saw Marquise and the wonderful. I saw Quinn today and told her, you know, he was so kind, he was so generous, he was so helpful, he was yes ma'am, no ma'am. And we told him that day, we took a picture with him, we're going to put it in our newsletter for the church, you know, we told him, your mama raised you right, your grandma raised you right, and it's awesome. I turn the corner at my doctor's office and I see a girl that I knew her before she was born. I know all of these feel like family to me. These people are family to me. But at the same time, it breaks my heart.
It breaks my heart because
I'm white and I can't be in relationship with them because of the way I want to be.
Yeah, Jamie, I hear you on that. I've tried to, and she's mentioned this before, and it breaks my heart to hear her say that. And with Peaches, your guidance and all, it does help. Please try to understand we're doing.
Right.
We're doing so much that
we're loving the only way that we know how. Right. And let's get back to the household project. The fact is, I hoped that this would be an inroad into the Black churches, in the all churches, the community churches, to be able to join together in a group activity to be able to support the people, period. And I have not gotten inroad at all to any Black church, to any Black community, to be able to hear me even. And I agree with Jess and Mary. And the fact is, I thought by the end of the first week, I would have 10 plus people that had signed on. But every single church has their own processes, has their own community, has their own things that they're giving to, that you have to travel. And I'm just like, Jess, what's the problem? Freaking A, you're going to the store, buy an extra one, and we should be able to put it out with no problem. So why are we sitting around talking about it when we just want to do it?
Yes, you were going to speak before. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Yes, this is perfect. I think this leads back into the doing. If we want to create those relationships, I think we can create the space. It's to say yes and. Like how y'all were saying earlier, to say like, hi, I'm Jess. I'm with the Village. I hope you're having a great day. Bringing back this point too, when I was mentioning the cards, like having information that tells about what we do as far as like creating space. There are days where people will come into this office and sit down and talk to Meryl about their whole day. No business, no typing on computers, no letters. They will just come in and talk. How do we create that space? It could be as much as just going into the comments and like Meryl likes to say, have feelings. Like, would you like to have feelings? Put a sign up. Some people will want to come and create that space. But I think these things are in conjunction, right? Some people don't want to like have feelings unless they have what they need. Sometimes necessities come before like relationship or necessities with relationships. I think everything we've been saying in this conversation is not like either or. I think it's both things are true. It is yes and. It is, hi, my name is Jess. I am with the Village at Ithaca. And it's also, hey, we're having an open space in the commons where you can feel free to play tic-tac-toe with us because we have a game of tic-tac-toe or we have a bingo night. We have a step showcase. Do one bingo night. We will do bingo night. but it's about creating those spaces. And at the same time, like coming back earlier, not to where it's a point of like, we're here and we're having bingo night and you need to come, but we have this space that is open if you would like to. Not to say that anyone was saying that, but just to make it a point in saying that if we want to create and cultivate those relationships, we should be able to create the space. But it's not so much as to like having conversation about creating the space. It's about, can we create the space? Let's leave a card if people don't want to come to, some people do want to come to the door. That's great. Amazing. Let's tell them about the space. Let's tell them we want to play a game with them or have coffee with them or whatever. And like, if they don't want to, let's leave a card that says, hi, my name is Jess. I hope you're having a great day. If you would like to know more about the people leaving the food at your door, please come into this space and we will welcome you with open arms. I don't really have too many conversations about how to cultivate relationships. I just know when I want to be someone's friend, I approach them in a way that would make them feel comfortable, whether that means talking to them directly or leaving a note. And if they would like to create that relationship with me, it's not about like hoping that they respond. It's that when the time comes, they will respond, because that's what a relationship is. It's me loving you and you loving me. Like, I, this is like a religious thing, but I know it says in the Bible, like, God loved us before we even knew who he was. And there was like, for me, with my relationship with God, like, that's how it was cultivated. Because God loves me, I love him. And with that, I do his work. I help his people, his children. We are all his children. So in that way, it's like, I can't help anyone who doesn't want to be helped. I can't force a relationship that no one wants. But what I can do is open the door for the people that want that relationship. Mm-hmm. And when the time is, when their time comes to where they want that relationship with me, I will be here. And if not, I pray that someone else is here to help out. And I think that's what we try to do with the Village at Ithaca. We provide the necessities. And then with the necessities comes the, we also have a space for you. Call me at 11 o'clock at night and I will come down here with my keys and I will open the door and I will sit down and have a conversation, because it's what you need and it's what I said I provided. And I think that's just my story and I'm sticking to it.
Chuck, I wanted to ask you, I want to pull you in here, and I'm insisting that you tell us what you're thinking, because I know you're a thinker, you know, tell us something.
No, thanks, Peaches. But I just concur. I resonate with what Jess just shared. I mean, I resonate with everything that's being said, because I'm a highly relational person. And so, but I also concur with you that it's a matter of just opening the door. And there's a part of me that says this is a no-brainer, and yet it's so difficult. And so it's just, I hear Jamie's heart, and I resonate with that. So I'm just trying to figure out how do we engage and get beyond the perceived, the real barriers that are there, and take concrete steps. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Eric.
I just want to honor what Jamie had said in that when relationships are formed and nested within an institution, it is very hard to get out of that. It is almost impossible, because the institution is like a prison, and it does not, the bars do not move easily on either side. And we have institutionalized racism. We have institutionalized classism so strong in this culture, and particularly in Ithaca.
Mm-hmm. Particularly in Ithaca, that's right.
Yeah, and classes and And I would, I didn't know I was poor until I came to Ithaca to go to Cornell, and then went back home to Missouri and also learned it a second time that I was poor there.
Yeah.
It's easier to be poor than it is to be an old white guy who has privilege, and it's fake, but it's real too. I mean,
I have to say that I've never seen such a racial mess as I've seen up here in Ithaca. And like I said, I came from craziness in terms of racism. And the mess is based on exactly what Eric is saying, that we have made everything into an institution. Our hearts are all in the right places. I can see that very clearly, and I respect that. And I respect that particularly in white people who are really working, I mean, to make a difference and to try to close these gaps. But I feel like we have imprisoned ourselves, or white people have certainly imprisoned themselves. Black people, yes, have their own prisons in terms of, not just in terms of being Black and being tired, but we have cultivated a society of resentment toward one another, and Black people and white people are both affected by it. And so, and I'm going to leave that for another conversation.
Sure. I think that's important that you said that, Peaches.
I say what's real. I don't, you know, I'm sorry. Like, that's just the reality. We've done a terrible job in this country.
Yes.
Cultivating this attitude of resentment. We see it in everything that we do. We do see it on social media. We see the meanness that's going on. We see the hate that's going on. And that's what we have taken a handle on. And it is affecting our racial relationships without a question. That's a tough thing to surmount. It's easier for me.
Right. But Peaches, and you, when you, the last time I saw you preach, you walked up to the pulpit and you said, "I love you. I love each one of you." And this is a white congregation, almost no persons of color in that congregation. And that's what you led with. And the resentment has to kind of part at that moment if it's real and if it's meant.
Yeah.
And for us to come in the same way with the humility to say that and be honest about it is incredibly tough, because there's no grandstanding here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the way I lead my life. You see, I don't lead my life that way because I'm part of UU. I don't lead my life that way because I worked in any institution. That's who I am as a person. And that is always going to come first. Always going to come first. You know, we forget that we are not our work. We are human and we have hearts. And to me, if we do our best to lead with that first, and of course, it's not always going to work. So let's get that conversation off the table, right? But you do it anyway.
Leading with your heart can be brutal, and you do it anyway. And you do find judgment from all sides. And that's why, you know, we get upset. That's why I understand you're, you know, it's not easy, but you still have to do it.
Hey, you think it's not easy for you? You think about my life.
I do. I could have
easily been the kind of person who hated white people. I saw the way my mother was treated. I saw the way my brother was treated. But I wasn't raised that way. And if you think it's a challenge, it's not a challenge to step into somebody's racism, which I have done often, and said, "I don't care. I know we both have things that make us human, that make us want the same things. Doesn't matter whether we're rich or poor, Black or white or anything else. I know we each have hearts that feel things, that we all hurt for things, we all mourn for things, and I'm going to find the humanity in you no matter where you come from. That's the way I live my life, not because I'm part of an institution. It's the way I live my life, and that is always going to come first when I do what I do. Maybe it sounds too simple. That's just the way it is, and it bothers me up here in Ithaca where it is so difficult, like you said, and like I said, on both ends, to move through those barriers, you know.
Let's take a moment and cut to music.
I dances grow standard. There ain't no hiding place from the Father of creation. Yeah, yeah.
One love.
What about the one?
One love.
What about the
let's get together and feel all right.
I'm pleading to mankind.
One love.
Oh, oh, oh.
One heart. Whoa. Give thanks and praise to the Lord.
And I will
feel all right. Let's get together and feel all right.
Give thanks and praise to the Lord. And I will
feel all right. Let's get together and feel all right.
You have, Peaches, a tremendous sense of personal agency. And people who don't have a strong sense of personal agency need the approval of an institution or the mandate of an organization or some rule or some value to live under. And if you have a sense of personal agency, you drive the value. And you also have to take responsibility for where it fails.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not doing well at this moment. And this is, I think, in a lot of people feel pretty helpless.
Yeah.
And what we need is to cultivate this sense of personal agency. And it's messy.
And also to stop, like, you know, what one of the things that really bugs me is, like, every time a white person fails in a relationship with a black person, but because they're not looking at them as being human, they're looking at them as a black person, right? Okay. They feel like they failed at something. When there are people out there, white, black, and any other color, who are just jerks,
yeah.
Okay? I'm sorry. They're just jerks. And we're not always going to hone our way into them just because we want to create a relationship with a black person. If sometimes we stop thinking about creating relationship with the person just because they're black, we might be more successful at creating relationship with a black person. Like, I came up here feeling like black people are a project for white people. Absurd. Absolutely absurd. Every time we're doing something, it's like, I feel like we're just a project. We're like a scientific experiment that you're studying. When black, white people say to me, and they've said it to me a million times in workshops and outside of workshops, how do I become friends with a black person? And I want to say, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, it's like a lot of people say, how do I become a better ally for a gay person?
Yes.
Why do you want to be an ally for me? It would be great if you would yes. choose to be my friend.
Yes, exactly. It's unbelievable.
You know? But here we are. Just this past week, I was up in Albany to a retiree union that I'm part of. And a black couple sat down with me at the table, a man and his wife. They were wonderful. They were beautiful in the conversation. I introduced them to my wife and in the conversation, and I told them that I'm retired, but I'm working part-time at St. Paul's United Methodist. So we went away. We had a great conversation. The next morning, she came down to have breakfast with him, and I was sitting there, and she said, I said to my husband last night that I think it's wonderful that you're working for the church, because that tells me that you're accepted for who you are working in the church. And she said, I'm kind of like, you know how like white people like to say they have one good black friend, you know, that sort of thing. She said, I'm a black person that likes to say I have a really good gay friend, you know. And she said, I see what they go through. And this has just really blessed me that you would be accepted at your church. And we've been looking for a church that would be accepting of all people, mm-hmm. including people who are gay. And so I was able to go on my phone and able to find, you know, a place in their area where they could have those things they're looking for. And I'm wanting to write a newsletter article to tell about this as I come back, you know, to say what a wonderful witness that was, even without me being at a church event.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, do I say, this black couple sat down by me, this African-American couple sat down by me, I don't know how to do it correctly, because whichever way I say it, I'm probably going to do it wrong. So then I'm second guessing, should I even relate this because of the fact that I'm going to get it wrong? So I think what you all have been saying is perfect. You know, yeah. I mean, it's like, do I say race? Do I say ethnicity? Do I say,
you know? It depends on how you frame it. Right. Mm-hmm. I had a relationship with this man at church that I knew for a few months, and I connected myself to him because he always seemed lonely. And he was a very old man, the man Hans, that just passed away. He always seemed lonely. Yeah. I knew that he struggled with racism. Yeah. I knew that he struggled with anti-Semitism. I knew all those things. And the way I crafted the eulogy that I am writing for him is to actually talk about how beautiful the relationship was, specifically because we broke down those barriers.
Right.
I didn't deny that the fact that he was a white man and I was a black woman and barriers he had to cross, seriously. I did not talk about it. My whole thing is to cross those boundaries life. And if we don't talk about that's what we're doing and that's meaningful to us, and I know that people can be offended by it, they can be, but this is your story.
Right. Yeah. A real relationship begins after the first offense.
Yeah.
After the first offense.
Yeah, because then you have to put it, then you have to figure out, what are we really here for? Because somebody's been hurt, somebody's been offended, and you're still coming back. Meryl, you were trying to break in a little while ago. Are you still?
Yeah, I think what I just wanted to, you know, sort of say to Jamie and Mary in particular, you know, I'm hearing you talk about things that are brutal and you're heartbreaking and trying so hard. And yeah, I mean, that's sort of how I approach my day. And that's actually one of the things I like about the fact that we're all on this call from sort of a faith-based perspective is that, you know, I'm from a Jewish family that informs all of my values. And for me, the way I go, if at the end of the day, I've done what I think I'm supposed to do to honor my God, then that's fine. And a lot of times that feels like failure and it feels like heartbreak and it feels like mistakes. And we're in a world that is full of struggle and failure and heartbreak. And there's a lot of people who have a lot more of it than I do. And so that's my expectation. I just get up and do it every day. You know, it's going to hurt. And like, it should, because why should I hurt less than another, right? Like that's, we are here suffering together. So that's the expectation. Get up and hurt.
Yep. I thank you for saying that. I feel like it's my duty to walk beside those who hurt. I might do it wrong. I might say the wrong thing. I might want the wrong thing, but I'm going to keep coming back because there's so much hurt there. And you can't judge a person when they lay their heart on the line and they're making mistakes. And what you said, Eric, that's so true. The relationship begins after the first offense. We're doing it. But we want to keep showing up.
So we've probably made more than one offenses by now. Is it possible for you all to help me to know how I'm going to get these things to deliver to Midland Dominica?
You're awesome, Jamie.
I'm just going to keep putting it out there. Because I want, before we get off of this phone call, I want to know how I'm going to get the other 7 pieces that I need for this month to take to these families.
Not our commitment. You got you.
Yeah, I've got 3 for sure. 1 piece here and 1 piece there and possibility of another one. But it's so slow.
It is so slow. It is so slow. But you have 4 congregations and ask them to fill the gap this month because they're already committed. And if you can share this conversation, because I think this conversation cuts to the heart of many profound issues in this community, maybe they will step up and they'll step up with more honesty.
I would love for this to be heard by all of our congregation. And do we just choose? I'm not aware of how.
This will air this Sunday. It will air a second time the following Sunday or 2 weeks after, one or the other. And it will be available online at madeofclay.org. And any congregation can listen to, a member or person can listen to it at any time they want to.
Wonderful.
But I think, Mary, for your church in particular, you're talking about small group and it was always has been my idea. You can see behind me here, the boxes, they're all made up. Each congregation takes a box, puts it in their foyer. You tell them, you don't ask them. You don't wait for them to hit you back on it. You just say, this month we're doing, you're doing hand soap and pump hand soap. And just to say, this is what we're doing. Next week, say, we have 10, now we need 20. And that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing at St. Paul's. And it seems to be working. We do have the buy-in by our pastor. We do have the buy-in. Yes, I had to go to local and world. But the fact is that we just keep putting, we don't wait until everybody says, okay, we'll do it. But that's what I'm having trouble convincing people to do. Take a box, say, we'll do it, period.
Well, what's happened is that in my small group of 8 people, 2 people come with me to deliver. So I think, oh, this is an opportunity to open up just a little bit more with that true connectivity instead of like volumes of people dump a toilet paper off. Okay, we did it. We're done.
Right.
It just didn't sound right.
If we start at least with people dumping off something, then we can broaden the base. You can only go up as fast as you are wide, you know, or we're going to fall over. So we just need to commit to a process because everybody else has their different processes. So this is good. Jess, would you be able to take a box to your congregation? That could help us come into, you know, that sort of thing. Peaches, I'm sure you would support Mary in having a box in the foyer or in the on the welcome room on the side, whatever you guys do. Just then pointing to it individually and getting those people to point to it individually and that sort of thing. And so, you know, I mean, if Chuck, if you went to a different church, hey, this is what we're doing. Would you? I mean, it's, I think the inroads are going to be in the relationships that we have built to be able to get it pushed out in these different places.
So. Right. So, and Jamie, just because we're coming near the end of our time, I would like to know how. This is a program to deliver household goods on a monthly basis through the Village at Ithaca to 30 families. And there are hundreds more if we could actually serve them. But Jamie, what is your contact information so people can find out what they need to know to get involved, to get their loving congregation care, or their community?
lovingcare@stpaulsithaca.org.
Okay, that's loving care as one word at stpaulsithaca.org.
And the phone number would be 607-592-9804. And that's my personal cell. You can call it anything. Great.
Okay, very good. Very good.
Okay.
Anything else before we call it a day from anyone?
Yes, I want Peaches's phone number.
We'll do that off air. So Jess, were you starting to say something there or
I just want to close out by saying thank you to everyone. I really appreciated everyone's opinions and concerns and cares. I think it's important that everyone knows that the care should go beyond waiting until there's trouble in the community. The care should be consistent. Just because we don't know about what's happening doesn't mean that there isn't a need. There is always a need. Yeah. And I think that care should continue to happen, not until we see another a Black person or person of color that has had a traumatic experience or has passed away. It's not about waiting until we see the notification that, oh, something terrible has happened. Like, we have to consistently share the care and share the love. It does not start at pain and it does not end at, oh, well, everything's fine now. It's been 2 weeks. We have to like consistently show up for our people. And as Chuck mentioned before, I know he mentioned the question of like, what are the concrete steps? What are the actionable steps that we are going to take outside of this conversation? I think it's important to remember that we need to consistently open our communities, open our doors in whatever communities those are, sharing the message, having posters, like letting people know that our doors are open. Village at Ithaca is having bingo night, like something people can come to us beyond, like, as everyone was saying, dropping off, even if it's like leaving a little note in the drop off bags that lets people know that this is what we're doing. Please. We are more, we are united. We are community. And everyone was asking, like, how do we build that community? We build that community by opening our doors. I don't know what the church has outside of Bible studies, but if y'all have more than Bible studies, like, y'all have a little line dance night, like let's show up for the community. And let's just continue to share love. And that's my thing.
I don't think a lot of people really subscribe to the ethic of better together. I think the silo of an institution is very thick-walled. And those who already have their food pantries and doing it believe that they've got the right solution. But if they were to subscribe to the idea, can we not collaborate? Can we not partner? Can we not have a better together ethic? Then I think a tremendous amount of energy would be released. And so how to break into that mindset, I think, is pretty significant. So
nice. You know, we have a tendency to respond to emergencies.
Yep.
And I see it in our ministry at UU, that our radars are dullened in terms of just wanting relationships, that we respond to emergencies. And when you do that, you're not casting a broad enough net of care. And that's what we do in our society. And that's what we do in our churches. And that's what we need to stop doing. We can respond to emergencies, but we also need to respond to people who are just there in a caring and loving way.
This is why we're emphasizing this is an ongoing project, that the items will rotate monthly so that you're not going back to the same people for the same thing every single month, but we can have a variety. But my goal is for us to be collective in our coming together. Homelessness is not, or need is not, a drive-by ministry where you just throw it out the door at people. You have to build relationships, and you're right. Absolutely right, Peter. Absolutely.
No, I think this was an amazing conversation, and I appreciate everybody being here and participating in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thank you all.
Thank you.
This is Eric Clay, co-host of the Made of Clay Report. Sunday mornings, 10 to noon. I welcome Peaches Gillette as a co-host in coming years. We discuss issues that challenge us, address people of diverse and conflicting opinions. We seek ways that we all may thrive, no exceptions. We are local radio from the community, by the community, and for the community. If you have comments or suggestions for these conversations, you can call 607-319-5445, extension 6, and we will receive those comments, or you can send them by email to info@madeofclay.org. That's 607-319-5445, extension 6, or info@madeofclay.org.